This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, as you may have heard, college tuition is out of control.
There have been 36 consecutive years of increases here.
Where's all that money going?
Water features and climbing walls and concierge services.
But one university is moving in the opposite direction.
The all-in cost of attending our school in 2021 will be less than it was in 2012.
Plus, some even more radical ideas from the private sector.
The school is free until and only if the students find a job that's over 40K.
There's a college tuition debt crisis in America, and it's even worse than you think. So, what's being done to fix it? That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. You recently called higher education a racket. You're selling a product that everyone is convinced is essential. It's got uncertain ROI, quality that's difficult to measure, and you can raise prices without losing customers. That doesn't sound like something we're used to hearing from a college president.
I was being a little facetious, of course, but I was making the point that at least until recently, higher ed has been in a very fortunate place where nothing much could go wrong. People did feel they had to have what it was selling, and they could charge almost anything they felt like. People had no way to know if they were getting a good deal or not, whether the quality was up to the price. And that's changing now and should.
It's changing in part because of this man.
I'm Mitch Daniels. I'm currently the president of Purdue University.
Purdue is a large, well-regarded state university established in 1869 in West Lafayette, Indiana. There are more than 32,000 undergraduates and nearly 10,000 grad students. It's best known for its business and engineering programs. It's produced more astronauts than any other non-military institution. Mitch Daniels spent most of his career not in academia, but rather in business. He worked for the pharmaceutical firm Eli Lilly and primarily in politics. He worked in two White Houses,
a former advisor to President Reagan, and George W. Bush's director of the Office of Management and Budget.
He became a popular two-term governor.
He was elected governor of Indiana in 2004 and turned around a struggling economy.
The state was broke when we got here, and we fixed that in a great big way.
Daniels was such an economic pragmatist.
An area Indiana has fared better than most states is by reining in the state budget.
That some people thought he might make it to the White House.
Now, the latest on the 2012 race and another potential candidate for president, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels.
But instead of that presidency, he's 6 years into this one at Purdue. And he's threatening to blow up the economic orthodoxies of college education. If you look at higher education as an industry, which you should, because essentially it is, then you'd have to acknowledge that this industry has been booming. Between 2000 and 2010, undergraduate enrollment at U.S. colleges increased by 37%. As demand rose, so did the price. From 2000 to 2016, the average annual cost of college more than doubled, from around $15,000 a year to nearly $32,000. Over the past 20 years, only two other goods or services have risen as much as college. One is hospital services. The other is college textbooks. Since 1985, college costs have risen four times faster than the consumer price index. Why? There are a number of reasons. One has to do with what economists call Baumol's cost disease. That's what happens when salaries rise, in this case, the salaries of college administrators and faculty and staff, without a commensurate rise in productivity. You also see this in the performing arts and in hospital services, by the way. Even though there's a lot of technology in hospitals and in colleges, they still require a lot of real people spending a lot of real hours to get the work done. It's not like manufacturing, where automation creates efficiencies. It's not like software, where the millionth copy costs way less to make than the first one did. Another reason the price of college has risen so much? because college has become even more valuable. People with a college education have always earned more than those without. But if you look at the data from 1970, and then from 2000, and then from 2015, the earnings gap between workers with and without a college degree has become an earnings chasm. And so, as Mitch Daniels said,
people did feel they had to have what it was selling, and they could charge almost anything they felt like.
Did the quality of the product rise along with the price?
The absence of any real objective way to measure what students are learning. Are they growing intellectually? In fact, we have some evidence that says they're not growing very much. But in the absence of any proof of quality, people have come to associate sticker price with quality. If it costs more, it must be better.
It also helped that the federal government and others were more than happy to lend money for college.
We know empirically, it's no longer somebody's theory, that flooding the marketplace with third-party subsidies, grants and loans and so forth, enabled higher ed to keep raising its prices. The New York Fed is the most recent of many to identify this phenomenon. And basically, they find that for every dollar of new public subsidy, colleges have raised their price between 60 and 70 cents.
So as demand for college was rising and costs were rising and loans were rising, you know what else has been rising, don't you? Student debt. It is hard to overstate the magnitude and the severity of the college debt load in the U.S. Roughly 45 million people have student loan debt, totaling $1.5 trillion. Of those who graduate from a public four-year university, nearly 60% have debt, with an average of more than $27,000. And those are the graduates. Roughly 40% of students at those schools don't graduate within 6 years.
And student debt, it doesn't matter whether the student gets a job, gets a good job, succeeds or doesn't. The bill is there, and it's going to compound. The interest is going to grow over time. There's no getting out of it, even in bankruptcy. And you can see that the consequences in individual lives, and now you can see the big consequences for us all, because young people are postponing buying houses, are postponing forming families, postponing having children. They're starting fewer businesses than they used to. Bad deal all around.
There's a lot of data to back up what Daniels is claiming here, that tuition debt is a huge drag on the economy overall. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell told the Senate Banking Committee last year that student loan debt, quote, absolutely could hold back growth. Some politicians are proposing a fairly radical solution. Elizabeth Warren, for instance, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts who's running for president.
That's why I'm calling for universal free college and the cancellation of student loan debt of up to $50,000 for 42 million Americans.
Should college be universally free? Some countries do provide that. Should all college debt be forgiven? Warren's plan calls for taxing the ultra-wealthy to come up with the money. But let's assume that near term, at least, college won't become universally free and college debt won't be universally forgiven. In the meantime, what can or should be done to make college more affordable?
There have been 36 consecutive years of increases here, as at virtually every other school, and some of those were not small.
Mitch Daniels became president of Purdue in 2013. One of the first things he proposed was a tuition freeze.
At the outset, all I imagined we might do is take a one-year time out.
How was that suggestion received? Daniels' previous job, remember, was governor of Indiana.
I remember saying, I think probably too sarcastically to folks here, I just landed here on Mars. But back on Earth, they're becoming really concerned about the high price of what we're doing here. And when I suggested maybe just a one-year pause, there were those among the enrollment professionals here who very genuinely said, oh my gosh, if we stand still while everyone else goes up again, people will think we don't have confidence in the quality of our product. And I said, I just don't think that's how the earthlings are looking at all this. So we did it.
And they did it beyond that 1 year. Tuition at Purdue has been frozen at least through the 2021 school year. The cost of room and board was also cut by 5%.
And so the all-in cost in nominal dollars of attending our school in 2021 will be less than it was in 2012. And that's not the economic model that most schools have pursued, but it's been working out well for us, and we'll continue operating on that philosophy the best we can.
How has Purdue managed to cut its price? Not by drawing down a lot more government money.
Our support from the state has been more or less flat.
No, the Daniels solution lay primarily in cost-cutting, the same kind of cost-cutting he practiced as governor of Indiana. On his first day as governor in 2005, Daniels established an Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, the same agency he'd run for the federal government. Indiana, at the time, had an $800 million budget deficit. Daniels preached efficiency and reform at every turn. He cut the state workforce and consolidated agencies. He created public-private partnerships to run highways and prisons. He repealed collective bargaining, decertified the public employee unions, and made Indiana a right-to-work state. In other words, textbook fiscal conservative moves. On balance, Daniels was incredibly popular. He even won awards for his wildlife conservation efforts. And John Kasich called him the Michael Jordan of governors. Now he's being called, by the Wall Street Journal, America's most innovative university president for making similar moves at Purdue. He's trimmed the budget of some big capital projects and killed off other projects entirely. He privatized the university's bus service. He replaced cafeteria employees with student workers. And he sent out furniture for repair rather than buying new furniture. Some Purdue faculty and staff have complained about the cost cutting. They say their compensation and benefits are being curtailed. They say departments increasingly compete against one another for resources.
Callers and cheers erupted when several staff and faculty members voiced their concerns about changes to Purdue's paid time off policy.
It's sometimes depressing to work at because it feels like it is bad thing after bad thing after cut after cut.
Some critics say Daniels' pursuit of corporate partnerships, like a textbook deal with Amazon, is not good for the university. Also controversial was Purdue's recent acquisition of the online for-profit Kaplan University, now called Purdue University Global, which delivered 30,000 new paying customers. Some Purdue professors worried this would tarnish their brand and spread the university too thin. Mitch Daniels argues that his combination of cost-cutting and a growth mindset is working out just fine.
We have grown our faculty actually faster than the student body. And we have one of the best ratios in America of faculty to students.
What about median wage of faculty, though, along with that growth?
Yeah, they're very competitive. In fact, across the spectrum of professors, assistant, associate, and full, 7, 9, and 13% above the nearest Big Ten school. And we have not shifted to less expensive or contingent or temporary faculty. We have the highest percentage of our faculty who are so-called tenure track among American research universities.
Under Daniels, Purdue's alumni donations, student retention rates, and graduation rates are all way up. And so are applications. They've risen from 31,000 a year to 53,000 during his tenure. Interestingly, this has happened during a recent decline in college enrollment in the U.S. Earlier, I told you that college enrollment rose 37% between 2000 and 2010. But from 2010 to 2016, it's down 7%. How should this decline be interpreted? You might say that we simply hit peak college a few years ago. The boom came up against its ceiling. Or you might say the price of college has simply become prohibitive for too many people. Or that would-be students and their parents are scared off by the horror stories about lifelong college debt. But you should also consider this fact. College enrollment tends to be correlated with the employment rate. When there are a lot of jobs available, some people skip college to take those jobs. And the employment scenario has improved in recent years, so that could also help explain the overall drop in demand for college. This drop in demand is already affecting the supply side. College closures, while still rare, have been rising. Some larger university systems, like the University of Wisconsin, are consolidating their campuses. For-profit colleges are particularly prone to suffer from less demand, and their numbers have decreased over the past several years. But a prestigious private college or a big public research university like Purdue, they are still seeing historically high demand. Some students and their parents are so eager to get into college that they'll pay bribes in the hundreds of thousands of dollars and pretend they play water polo. So what does all this mean for the future of college tuition and for long-term debt? More and more elite schools with huge endowments are offering free tuition for anyone whose family can't afford it. But that covers a relatively tiny portion of the college population. So yes, Purdue makes news by freezing its tuition for several years, but it still charges Indiana residents around $20,000 a year for tuition plus room and board. Non-residents pay nearly $39,000, and international students pay over $41,000. And so, coming up after the break, Mitch Daniels and Purdue are trying something much more radical than a tuition freeze.
So an income share agreement, I first saw it in an essay by Milton Friedman from 50, 60 years ago.
Purdue isn't the only school trying an income share agreement.
Once they find a job that is paying them a nice salary, it is 17% of your income for 3.5 years.
Also, lessons from the Australian version. That's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Mitch Daniels grew up mostly in Indianapolis. He studied public policy and law at Princeton and Georgetown, respectively, and went on to work in the federal government under Presidents Reagan and Bush the Younger. He was also a pharmaceutical executive and was CEO of the Hudson Institute, a conservative think tank. Since 2013, Daniels has been the president of Purdue University, where he froze the price of tuition and cut the cost of room and board. That alone is enough to make him an outlier in the college pricing market. But there's more. One program at Purdue that you've instituted that I'm really interested in, I think everybody would be interested in, is what's called Back a Boiler. The Purdue Boilermakers is the mascot. It's an income share agreement in which, if I understand correctly, students can defer some or all, I'm not sure, tuition payment in favor of repaying Purdue a share of their later income.
You have the essence, right? It's not a deferral of tuition. And Purdue gets paid, but instead of the check coming from the federal government in a loan, it comes from an investment fund. We participated, but so did other foundations and now in some private investors. And think of it as equity, not debt. So the student doesn't borrow the money. The risk shifts from the student to the investor. If things don't work out well, it's the investor or the investment fund that's on the hook. Quite the opposite of student debt. So an income share agreement, I first saw it in an essay by Milton Friedman from 50, 60 years ago. It's not a complete replacement, but it's a better option, certainly than the private loans that many students have to take on. There's a lid on how much of the heavily federally subsidized loans a student can take. And when they need more, they sometimes wind up with these pretty expensive debt instruments. So, you know, I talk about this as, you know, working your way through college after college. And if it doesn't work out, again, you're not on the hook. Just so the audience will understand, a typical one, and it would vary with what the student studied, but a chemical engineer from Purdue University would pay about 2.5% of income for maybe 6 or 7 years. Somebody who studied let's say psychology, it might be 4 or 5% of income, whatever that income is.
And just to be clear, that's because a psychologist is making a lot less than a chemical engineer, correct?
Likely to make less.
Now, let me ask you this from the investor's perspective. Let's say I'm invested in the fund that is funding this backup boiler program. To what degree can I handpick the students that I'm investing in? Can I buy a tranche of just the chemical engineering students, or do I have to have the psychology and history students in there too?
You can't cherry pick the way we're doing it. You know, if this thing becomes a broad national movement, there could be all kinds of ways others might approach it. We're in our third year now, getting close to 1,000 students total, and beginning to accumulate some experience. Still early days, but the repayment history is very good for all of them. And, you know, we have consumer protections. Some of our graduates are going to hit the jackpot early. They're going to do so well, happens every year, they're going to get promoted two or three times. There's a top cap beyond which you're not required to.
It's 2.5 times the initial outlay, is that right?
2.5 times what was invested. You know, the real thing that we hope to happen here is that this movement will spread, and a lot of other schools start to get interested in it because they see it'd be better for their students.
There are indeed a lot of other schools, and startups, by the way, looking into income share agreements, or ISAs, as a way to rewrite the college tuition equation.
One of the beauties of an ISA is that you're aligning interest with a student.
Christine Bredemeyer is head of admissions and enrollment at the Holberton School. That's a for-profit software engineering college that opened in 2016 in San Francisco. It's now got a few other campuses.
The school is free until and only if the students find a job that's over 40K. And once they do find a job that is paying them a nice salary, typically our students are earning over 100K as their first full-time software engineering position. It is 17% of your income for 3.5 years.
How does Holberton cover the costs of running a school if they're not taking in tuition? Partly through private investors, like any startup, but also through $2 million in investments drawn from Edly, an online marketplace for income share agreements.
So I think the easiest way to think about Edly is it's kind of like the NASDAQ, although you're not investing in companies or corporations, you're investing in human potential. Investors only see a return on their money when a student is successful, and same goes for us. So everyone is playing the same game. We want our students to actually find successful jobs.
Holberton's founders were also interested in diversifying the tech world. In that regard, offering free tuition is useful.
So it's giving a lot more people access to quality education. We have over 60% people of color, 30% plus women. We have a lot of college dropouts. We have teachers and artists, a lot of musicians. Over 40% of our students are first-generation post-secondary students. And 30% of our students, English is not the main language spoken at home.
Holberton says that all of their first 105 graduates are employed and that all of them are paying their Holberton dues as scheduled.
If our students are not getting jobs, then we don't get paid and we close as a school. And I think colleges, that's what they kind of set out to be originally, was to help get students into careers.
Another career-building school with free tuition is Lambda, an online learning startup backed by Silicon Valley's Y Combinator, among others. Lambda offers programs in fields like data science and UX design at no charge, with Lambda getting 17% of a graduate's salary for 2 years, as long as they get a job paying more than $50,000, with payments capped at $30,000. So, yes, there seems to be momentum for the private for-profit model of an income-sharing agreement, but what about the traditional nonprofit college model? And what kind of role can or should government play? The Obama administration pushed to make federal loans cheaper and put an interest rate cap on loan payments, but other countries have gone much, much, much further. Australia, for instance, has for decades offered free tuition, letting graduates pay back the government once they're employed, with the payments collected through the federal tax system. That is a very tidy system, especially if most of the universities are state-run, as they are in Australia. There was, however, one big loophole. What if an Australian graduates from college and then moves abroad to work? Aren't they stealing a free education from everyone else who stays behind and pays back their tuition? Australia only managed to close this loophole in 2016 after more than 25 years of expatriate Aussies not paying their government. I wondered about a similar loophole when we had Rhode Island Governor Gina Raimondo on our show last year. She had just made community college in Rhode Island tuition-free. That led me to ask her this. What kind of residency requirement is there afterwards? If I get a free community college degree from you and then I move immediately to Massachusetts or California, do I have to pay you back?
We ask them to make a pledge that they'll stick around for a couple years. So yes, the deal is you have to go full time because we want people to graduate. You have to keep up a minimum grade point average. Can't get into trouble. Got to be in academic good standing. And we want you to live in Rhode Island for at least 2 years after you graduate.
Raimondo may want them to live there so that Rhode Island recaptures the tuition funding through state income taxes, but Rhode Island currently imposes no penalty if a student gets a free tuition and moves away. It's the Australia loophole. In New York State, meanwhile, Governor Andrew Cuomo is not taking any chances. His plan to offer free college to qualifying families requires graduates to stay in New York for at least as many years as they received free tuition. Otherwise, their tuition bill will be converted into a no-interest loan that would have to be repaid. You can see why this sort of plan, free college education with repayment through the tax system, why it'd be easier at the federal level with the IRS doing the collecting. In fact, a friend of mine is currently trying to design such a system, and he's gathering allies from the education and financial and political communities. So if you are a high-ranking elected official, Democrat or Republican, and you want to hear more from my friend and his allies, drop me an email, radio@freakonomics.com, and I'll hook you up. My friend, like many others who are trying to think creatively about the college tuition debt problem, recognizes that the current system is unsustainable, and that it could be really damaging to our long-term economy and to our society. But a smart solution will require a lot more political will than would seem to be available at the moment, especially at the federal level, where political affiliations are so polarized these days as to render bipartisanship nearly impossible. Political affiliation is also a big issue on college campuses, and I asked Daniels about this. Colleges and universities in the U.S. are famously liberal, at least in terms of political identification among faculty, let's say. So one study of more than 7,000 professors from 40 leading U.S. universities found a Democratic to Republican ratio of 11.5 to 1. In some disciplines, it's less. Economics is less. Law is less. But in others, it was much higher. In journalism, it's 20 to 1. In history, it's 33.5 Democratic to 1 Republican. Obviously, you are a Republican. You are a university president. I realize that Purdue and Indiana are generally more conservative than a lot of other parts of the country. But still, I'm curious what you think this says about the state of universities generally and what can or should be done about it.
Well, first of all, I'm not a Republican. I'm really since the middle of 2012, on the day I accepted this job, I said I would forswear any partisan activity out of respect for the place, and I've maintained that. But, you know, those ratios, it's a self-selection process. People probably pick people more like themselves. Meanwhile, I think a lot of folks deselect. They just say, I wouldn't be comfortable there. I'd be isolated or ostracized. And so you do that for two or three generations, you're probably going to get where we've gotten. But I think young people, by and large, they've got pretty good BS detectors. And I think they can, over time, figure out if they're being force-fed or not offered a range of facts and opinions to consider. But here's the real problem, as a lot of recent books have pointed out. The advance of knowledge, forget politics and ideology for a minute, the advance of knowledge requires the collision of ideas. And that's what's beginning to trouble, I think, even people of more liberal or leftist persuasion, is where you get this complete homogeneity, this just dreary conformity. And then the free inquiry stops being the driver of new discoveries and ideas.
Coming up after the break, what's it cost to get a college degree without actually going to college?
It was about $2,400 and you had a $500 discount. So let's go in at $2,000.
The very robust market in counterfeit college credentials, that's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hello, Mr. Ezell?
Yes.
Hi, Stephen Dubner. Nice to meet you.
Stephen, nice to meet you. And you won't believe what I'm holding in my hand.
Let me guess, because I just got a degree in psychic work, so I'm
impressed. Over the internet?
Of course. Where else? I'm going to say that you have in your hand a diploma, maybe from Appalachian State University?
Yes, founded in the year 1899. And I like their logo down at the bottom.
Uh-huh. And what did I get my degree in?
Oh, I have no idea. This is a blank.
Oh, so it can be whatever I...
Sure.
You know, I've always wanted to be a vet.
Well, if that turns you on, then that's fine. And I'm sure that the animals would have fun with your children.
And do you maybe also have a graduate degree from Columbia University as well?
The trustees of Columbia University and the City of New York, to all persons to whom these represents may come greeting, be it known that, having completed the studies and satisfied the requirements for the degree of, and it's a blank also.
Ah, hot diggity. You know, because I did get a degree in writing there, but I really thought I should have become a doctor instead. So,
hey, you can be whatever you want to be. Remember, I've got two MDs.
Now, for the record, I really did go to college. I got my undergraduate degree in broadcast journalism, actually, at Appalachian State University, and I got an MFA in writing from Columbia, which is why Alan Ezell brought those particular diplomas to the radio studio. Now, you may be asking, who is Alan Ezell, and how did he get hold of these blank diplomas? Well, he used to work for the FBI.
I retired in late 1991, and for 12 years, I handled what was called Operation Dip Scam, Diploma Scam, and it was a series of investigations on degree mills, diploma mills, throughout the United States, and some were abroad.
Now, it should be said, you say that you handled this investigation, but you're being a little modest here. You created this investigation, didn't you?
Well, that's true, too.
Here's how it started. One day in 1980, an informant came into Ezell's FBI office in Charlotte, North Carolina, and laid a couple of fake college diplomas on his desk. He told Ezell about a man in Greenville, South Carolina, who was selling them. So Ezell made a phone call. He didn't say he was with the FBI. He said he was an accountant, hoping to get a promotion. That first day when you got on the phone with the president of the university in Greenville, South Carolina, what was the name of that university?
Southeastern.
Southeastern. And was it a real college at all?
That word, real. Yes, it was. Well, it's a relative term.
Yeah.
There was a point in time, probably 11 years before that, that it did have a building. There later came a point in time when it, and they had a fire or something, when it stopped being real in that sense. And then the proprietor started operating the school out of three rooms of his house.
What was this fellow's name?
Dr. Alfred Jarrett.
Okay, so you called him up that day. You called up Dr. Jarrett at Southeastern University. And what did you say to him?
We negotiated the price for my bachelor's, master's, and doctorate with no work whatsoever.
Wait, you bought a bachelor's, master's, and a doctorate all at once?
Sure, triple combo, have it backdated, you know, with transcript.
During that conversation, Ezell made it sound as if he and a colleague might be helpful to Jarrett in growing his diploma business. So Jarrett invited them for a visit.
He took us on a tour of his house and the three rooms involved. He showed us the school filing cabinet. He showed us our student files and the other student files. He showed us blank diplomas, transcripts, seals, ribbons, all the trappings that it would take. Now, all of this information we use in our affidavit for the federal search warrant.
Ezell and some other FBI agents put together their case and then went back to see Jarrett, this time with a search warrant.
I tried to explain to him that life is not over, that this is just a search warrant. So we spent 2 or 3 hours there. We did what we were supposed to. And then we left town and went back to Charlotte. We had not even read all the boxes of stuff that we had. When we did read it, we saw that he had approximately 600 plus graduates over 11 years. We had federal, state, and county employees. We had law enforcement. You name the profession, we had it.
And that was Alan Ezell's introduction to the world of fake diplomas. Over the next decade, he helped uncover a huge counterfeit market, companies all over the country doing millions of dollars worth of business.
We bought 40 degrees. We had 16 federal search warrants, 19 federal grand jury indictments, about 21 convictions. We dismantled 40 schools and/or counterfeit operations. The highest gross revenue that I saw then, and this is pre-internet, was $2 million. Now, after the internet came about, $2 million that I was seeing for a gross revenue is not even pocket change. We're now seeing $36 million, $7 million, $5 million, and the Lollapalooza, the biggest one that we have ever seen, called University Degree Program. And they operated from 98 through about 03. By our calculations, they grossed $453 million. And the paper that they sold will pollute the market for years to come. And what makes it even worse, they sold degrees in anesthesiology, cardiology, dermatology, endocrinology, gastroenterology, neurology, obstetrics, oncology, ophthalmology, pediatrics, psychiatry, radiology, surgery, urology. And I would ask you, where do you think the people are employed that bought degrees in those majors?
Well, that's what I want to know, Alan, because if you're saying this one firm grossed 450 some million dollars over what, a 5 year period, the average price, let's say, was $1,000, let's say.
No, it was more.
More
it was
than
about $2,400 and you had a $500 discount. So let's go in at $2,000.
Even so, that's more than 200,000 totally fake degrees.
I told you they were the Lollapalooza.
And that's one firm. So
yeah.
I have two questions for you. One is, where the hell are all these fake doctors and how do I stay away from them? And two is, if there are 200,000 roughly from one firm, how many fakes are we talking about in toto?
We have no idea. Let me put it this way. The United States, all the colleges and universities in our country, award about 1.3 million degrees a year. Approximately 1% of that, we believe, is the amount of phony degrees that are sold in our country each year. As to where these people are that bought those degrees, we don't have a clue. And I say that because no one in law enforcement, federal law enforcement, chased them. We don't know who they are. We don't know where they're employed. Only occasionally will a graduate flush up. He could be practicing in a hospital. He could have something go awry in a medical procedure, and then they start looking at his credentials and then find out he's a phony. You would be shocked at the number of people that buy this garbage and then put it on their resume and then post this online.
We interviewed Ezell a while ago. Today, nearly 2 million undergraduate degrees are issued each year. Assuming that same 1% share of phony degrees, roughly 20,000 of them are fake. When Ezell retired in 1991, Operation Dip Scam ended. And, he says, the FBI pretty much stopped investigating fake degrees. The industry has exploded since then. And today, you can buy just about any kind of degree online. There are two basic kinds of operations. One is simply a counterfeiting company, which sells fake versions of real degrees from the university of your choice. The other is a diploma mill, essentially a fake university that issues its own degree, like Southeastern University and Dr. Jarrett. Sometimes a diploma mill will ask you for a resume and award course credits based on your work history. Occasionally, you'll have to do some actual work.
I mean, the most I've ever done is 5 pages on a master's, okay?
But a lot of the time, you just pay the fee.
Smash and grab. Here's my check. Give me my degree.
So imagine you've got a low-level job and you want a promotion that requires additional schooling, but you don't want to go back to school. So you tell your boss you're working on a degree at night, and then a year or two later, you give your boss your new fake diploma. Hey, thanks, Diploma Mill.
As of today, there's no federal criminal legislation regarding using diploma mill paper in this regard.
You sound as though you're not happy that there is no law against that.
Oh, no, I've never been happy. The way you get somebody's attention is with some handcuffs, okay? The threat of a civil fine or embarrassment will not do it. We need a federal law that forbids the diploma mills, non-accredited institutions, institutions that don't have regional or national acceptable accreditation. It should not be this easy.
Does it still burn you after all these years of pursuing these guys to know that people are cheating so baldly?
Oh, it always has. I mean, I have two daughters, one that graduated from University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, one that graduated from the University of Florida. I have bought counterfeits of both of their school diplomas with transcripts. And I probably paid less than $800 for both. And you can imagine the thousands of dollars to send them to school. No, I cannot take away their level of learning that they had by going to school. But by buying a counterfeit, I can devalue the piece of paper that they walked out with at the end. Because it undermines all of our legitimate education. Every one of us that have spent time, money, effort, sweat, all-nighters, it devalues the degrees that we have.
If Azell's ballpark guess is true, that roughly 1% of college degrees are fake, just think about that. If you work in government or healthcare, or maybe in public radio, for every 100 coworkers, one of them is a fraud. You've got to wonder if there's something about how we look at real college degrees that makes a fake one so attractive and so easy to get.
You can be whatever you want to be.
You can be whatever you want to be. We say that a lot, parents to kids especially. But what we really mean is you can be whatever you want to be, but first, you need a college degree. Now, degree mills exploit our collective college anxiety, and they tell people, don't worry about the education. It's the piece of paper that gets you the job. Plus, a real degree is expensive. Not only the money itself, but 4 years of your life. Here's the thing. When you look around at a variety of fields, you can find some really, really successful people who did not finish college. And not just in sports and entertainment. I'm talking about people at the top of knowledge fields where smarts are key. So Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Richard Branson. Even in politics, you can find a few.
Hey, Stephen, how are you?
That's Karl Rove, former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff for President George W. Bush. Rove is currently a commentator for Fox News and a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. And at first glance, Rove's academic credentials seem to be commensurate with his achievement. So here's what I read from your bio, that you were a Colorado native who attended the University of Utah, the University of Maryland, College Park, George Mason University, and the University of Texas at Austin. But what I can't tell from that is if you actually graduated college. So tell me if you did or not.
No, I never did. Otherwise, I'd say I was a graduate of one of those colleges.
In each case, in each of these universities, when you were enrolled, were you a political science major?
Yes. Probably the most useless degree that one can seek, but I'm sort of stuck.
Rove is widely considered to be a political genius. He was the architect of President Bush's two electoral campaigns, and he had a lot of policy influence in the White House. And he's a guy who left college because it just wasn't worth it to him. He found he could learn more in the field than in a classroom. Listening to him, you start to think, if you can learn so much by doing, why bother getting a degree?
But mine's an atypical experience. I mean, I think I was in the last generation that could be stupid enough not to get a college degree. I think you live in a society in which credentials matter. I mean, the Bill Gates of the world who go on to found Microsoft after dropping out of Harvard are few and far between. The Karl Roves who go on to be, senior advisor to the president after, never completing your degree are few and far between.
Rove points out that he did learn a lot in college, but not the kind of things you might expect.
The best course I ever took in college was in my sophomore year, and it was a course in Shakespearean literature. I learned more about political communications in that one semester from a Catholic nun than I learned in any political science course. It made me aware of the power of language and how telling a story, a political campaign is about big issues, but you have to describe a narrative. You have to create a storyline. What is this all about?
So as of today, how close are you to getting your undergraduate degree? How many credit hours shy are you?
I think I'm my language requirement and about 6 hours or 9 hours beyond that. Math course, science course, and language is what I think. Now, the language is going to kill me.
And realistically, you think you're ever going to get your college degree?
Let's keep it out there as a goal. Life is about, upward vision, about moving towards the ever higher plateaus and mountain peaks. So let's keep it out there.
We don't really know why different people choose different levels of education.
That's David Card. He's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley.
Some people think it's all parental background. Some people think it's other attributes.
If you ask an economist like David Card a simple question about college, like, is it worth it? He'll tend to focus on the most tangible outcome, what economists call the returns to education, which pretty much boils down to how much more money you'll make if you go to college.
In my family, we have all five possible levels of education. We have somebody who didn't finish high school, someone who just finished high school, somebody who has kind of 3 years of college, vocational college, somebody who has a bachelor's degree with a teaching certificate, and then me who has a PhD. And if you just were to look at our family every step of the way, the returns to education are enormous. I mean, totally enormous.
So the one who did not finish high school does what for a living?
Basically cleans houses.
Uh-huh, yeah. And is the level of educational attainment kind of a conversation in the family, or is it something that is just known, acknowledged, and, that's the way it is?
Well, I think like many families, the next generations, people say, well, should we try and convince this kid to go to college or not?
Yeah.
And it's easy to say, well, look, if you go to college, you're going to have a little bit easier choices to make.
Yeah.
Once you get through that, things are going to be a lot easier for you. If you don't have it going forward, I think anybody who has kids who can possibly make it through a bachelor's degree should really think of some way to get them through.
Yeah.
Because I don't see much of a future 20 years from now for the kid who doesn't have that.
It's always tempting to cast about for the anomalies, the billionaire who dropped out of college, or on the other hand, the PhD who's driving a taxi. But let's not get distracted by the anomalies. If you want to measure the value of education, you have to think in the aggregate, and that's what economists like to do. Here's my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt, an economist at the University of Chicago.
Well, the best way I think an economist thinks about the value of education is tries to figure out how the market rewards it and what other benefits come with. And one thing is clear, is that the market puts a tremendous reward on education. So the best estimates that economists have are that each extra year of education that you get is worth about maybe an 8% increment to your earnings each year for the rest of your life. So it turns out for most people, buying a lot of education is, or at least for the average person, let me say, buying a lot of education is a really good deal.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or on the Stitcher podcast app. And you can get the most recent episodes or subscribe on any podcast app, including Apple Podcasts. As always, thanks for listening.